Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists. And for almost the last 12 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, it was a roller coaster of a weekend for fight fans. A whole lot of shit happened, and maybe a whole lot of ups and downs, depending on what you were hoping for. PFL went over to France last Thursday, got a very weird outcome, with Cedric Doumbé getting some kind of a splinter stuck in his foot, just when you thought you had seen it all in this sport. You had Francis Ngannou getting just brutally knocked out in his second professional boxing match against Anthony Joshua. So that leaves Ngannou's boxing future perhaps in serious doubt for the time being, but maybe also hastens his timetable for returning to MMA. And of course, we had UFC 299 on Saturday night, where Sean O'Malley got the first successful defense of his men's bantamweight title with just an absolute masterclass against Marlon Chito Vera. So this has become a little bit of a habit for us in the wake of these big UFC pay-per-views. We're going to spend the majority of this episode answering listener mail questions. We got a lot of good ones over the weekend. Unfortunately, we're not going to get to all of them, but we're going to try to answer as many as we can. First of all, let's tackle the big news from the weekend. And that was Sean O'Malley going down there to Miami, and I think solidifying his position as one of the UFC's real bright young stars with just an ass-whipping of Chito Vera. How did you rate O'Malley's performance coming out of Saturday?
It's honestly hard to do a whole lot better than that.
Yeah.
You know, especially against a guy like Chito Vera. The thing we all knew about Chito Vera going into this was that the dude is tough. The dude is durable. He could take a shot. It's going to be hard to get him out of there. And Sean O'Malley did about as much as anybody has. Some of those shots that Chito Vera took, you're just like, damn.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're still standing here. And how you're still standing here with a willingness to come forward and fight. By the end of that fight, when he took to the mic and was given his post-fight interview, I was like, it is going to be a while before Chito can use the Face ID to open his phone.
Yeah.
He's going to be typing in that code for at least the next few days, if not weeks. His face had completely changed by the end of that fight. And to his credit, I think he knew his potential path to victory in this fight looks like grinding into the later rounds, getting O'Malley to slow down a little bit, and he needed to make it a little bit more of a brawl. He needed to get into a little bit more of a phone booth fight there to have a shot. and that he was probably going to have to take some shots in order to do that, because Sean O'Malley was just a lot faster than he was. You could see that early on. You could see when O'Malley was able to keep him at his range, there was not much of a contest there. He was not in any trouble. It did occur to me the way the fight ended, where Chito landed a good body shot that made Sean O'Malley, instead of being able to walk around with his hands up, do that whole thing after the fight. He had to take a moment, you know, had to take a moment to gather himself right after the fight ended. And I was like, if this were the old timey days, if this were back in the London prize ring rules, where they would get into what they used to call a finish fight, where we're just going to keep going until somebody can't go anymore, then I don't know, maybe. I'm coming dangerously close to talking about Stockton rules here. But if you had to just keep fighting until one of you can't fight anymore, then maybe Chito's odds start to go up.
Well, and then I guess Sean O'Malley is lucky that we had this fight in the year of our Lord 2024, the yes. modern day UFC, and not like in a bar room in the Lower West Side with everybody putting their cash on the top of a barrel to place wagers on the fight. I agree with you about Chito Vera's chances to win, and it seemed like the other person that knew that that's what Chito Vera needed to do to win was Sean O'Malley, because he largely dictated the range of this thing. He pretty much dictated the pace. His movement was tough for Chito Vera to keep up with, and I think that it was tough for Vera to get into a distance and a range where he thought he could work his game. Tough to get into a rhythm. Like by the end of the fight, you clearly saw his best offense came just by rushing forward, basically, mm-hmm. and kind of spamming heavy shots out there. And, you know, it's just a reminder to me that you can't stand on the outside and try to fight Sean O'Malley, because he's just going to pick you apart from out there. And in that way, it was really a masterclass for Sean O'Malley to kind of show what he is capable of when he can get you into the kind of fight where he's going to flourish. And so that's exactly what he was able to do. I wondered, though, in the wake of this, you talked a lot just positively just now about Chito Vera, but you come out of this thing and you kind of think, well, that's a fight that at least in retrospect was tailor-made for Sean O'Malley to look good. And it made me wonder, like, would Chito Vera have been in this position to go in and fight Sean O'Malley on Saturday if not for their first fight?
No.
At UFC 252, when he essentially dealt Sean O'Malley his first only career quote-unquote loss, because it seemed like we were really banking on that kind of as a rivalry and a building block for this fight. And then if you wanted Sean O'Malley to go out there and prove that he's better than Chito Vera, he did that pretty comprehensively.
Yeah, and I mean, at least when I talked to Sean O'Malley before this fight, he was quite upfront about that. He said, let's be honest, there's no way Chito gets this title shot right now if it wasn't because we have this history together and there's a narrative there to sell. And honestly, I think the UFC sold it well. It worked to that extent. It worked to every possible extent that it was meant to work, where you have a narrative you can sell. This was, seems like probably going to be one of the biggest UFC pay-per-views of the year. You know, UFC 300 is going to be big just because we're loading it up so much. But this one, we were all talking about how stacked it is, how interested we were to see the whole fight card, and have this one felt very much like a suitable headliner for it. So it worked in that sense. It also worked in the sense of Sean O'Malley's your new champ. He's been an underdog in a whole bunch of fights. He was an underdog against Aljamain Sterling, but he got the belt. You have a whole lot of marketability here that you could potentially sell. You want to turn around and have him look good in a fight rather than have him lose the belt right away. So Chito's a pretty good opponent for that. A tough guy who can take a beating and will take a beating. And so 5 rounds of Sean O'Malley basically styling on him, like, that is pretty good to help build up the star power of Sean O'Malley. The question of what you do with him now, I think, is kind of interesting.
Yeah, he jumps on the mic after it's over and calls out Ilia Topuria for a featherweight title fight to try to become a champ, I guess, Sean O'Malley wants to do. He wants to have it over there in Spain, which I think, to O'Malley's sort of brainstorming credit, that would be legitimately be a pretty massive fight for the UFC and for both of the fighters. But at the same time, you still got Mirab Dwalishvili. hanging around, looking incredibly dangerous against everyone that he has fought in the lead up to number one contender status. And frankly, if I were the men's bantamweight champion, I'd be looking around for other fights too. Even if it's Ilya Topuria, one where I will probably have my work cut out for me in a whole different kind of way. But I guess the question is, is that what you do? Do you cut and run if you're promoters, if you are matchmakers? Do you cut and run from the men's bantamweight title chase in order to put a fight like this on that would be massive, but at the same time features two very new champions, neither of whom have come anywhere close to cleaning out their respective divisions?
Honestly, just from the perspective of the UFC, I think the big homie Luke Thomas might call it promotional malpractice if you miss a chance to put together O'Malley versus Topuria in Spain. Like, if that is feasible, if the timetable for everybody works out and you have a venue in mind that you could go and you could do that in Spain, or really to do it anywhere, like, that's a big fight and this moment might not come again. We all remember the year of the super fight, Chad.
Yeah.
Where those super fights did not materialize. If the opportunity exists, you got to jump on those. And like you said, I mean, I think O'Malley versus Merab for the bantamweight title is a perfectly fine fight. Makes sense in every possible way. The heads will love it. We'll all get super excited about it, break it down the stylistic matchup of it. However, it's not going to be a massive UFC event the way it would be if you could do something like, you know, two of your hot young stars going up against each other. The added bonus is that if O'Malley goes up there and fights Topuria, who I think is a much, much worse fight for him than Merab. Like, you know, Merab, he brings some challenges, does a whole different sort of thing, but Sean O'Malley has some openings there. Like, it's just a question of who gets to do their stuff. Against Ilya Topuria, O'Malley could go out there and do his stuff and still get starched. Like, that could just absolutely happen. It's a tough, tough matchup for him. However, he could go up to featherweight, Chad, fight for that belt, lose, and still be the bantamweight champ. He could still then come back home to his division and be like, all right, Merab, I'm going to give you your shot now. Like, I feel bad for Merab thinking about him having to wait still longer when it seems like he's been sort of the heir apparent. He's been the guy who makes sense next in line for a while now. But if you're the UFC, I think you go ahead and you make that fight if you can, and then you'd be like, the Merab one ain't going anywhere, you know?
See, I'd rather fight Topuria than Merab if I'm Sean O'Malley, because at least if you fight Topuria, it's only going to hurt for a short time.
At least if you fight Topuria, you won't remember that entire day.
Yeah, you're just going to wake up comfortable on the canvas, looking at the lights with a ref and a doctor kneeling over you. If you fight Merab, it's going to be 25 minutes of getting tired and him punching you. Not hard enough to knock you out, but hard enough to give you bruises. You're going to have cage marks all over your back. It's not going to be fun. So, I don't know. I'm taking the paycheck and the chance that you get knocked out instead of a grueling 25-minute cheese grater of a fight against Merab Dvalishvili. But that's just me.
Waking up on Sunday morning being like, all right, guys, it's fight night, right? I'm ready to go out there and fight Ilya Topuria. And then seeing the looks on the faces of your cornermen and being like, oh, wait a minute. Now that I think about it, my face hurts. Was the fight actually yesterday? Do you guys have some bad news you got to tell me?
All right, we got this question from David Putty, who writes, he seemed to have, yeah, I know.
From Seinfeld's David Putty?
Okay. It's nice to have Seinfeld characters continue to email the show. He says, he seemed to have massive support during fight week and in the arena on Saturday, but after suffering such a resounding defeat, what does the future hold for Marlon Chris Moutinho Vera? See, that's not nice.
How dare you, David?
Would the UFC go to Ecuador with such a passionate fan base? I feel Marlon could still be the centerpiece of some fun events in the future. Hard to know, man. This seems like the high water mark to me for Chito Vera, but you know, who knows? Who knows what could happen to him? He's only 31. He could still fight on for a handful of years and be in his prime. But this just seemed to me like this is the title shot. This is the arch nemesis, the guy you have a quote-unquote feud with, if you're Marlon Vera, I don't know, man. I think you got your work cut out for you to get back to a position like this.
Yeah. The UFC is not going to Ecuador. So put that out of your mind right now. I also kind of had a moment where when Merab was given his interview and he was like, I'll be back up here again. I'm going to fight for the title again. And I went, I don't know, man. I don't want to be a dick about it, but I don't know if you will. Like, I think that this might have been the best chance that you were kind of going to get here. Who knows? Who knows how those divisions can shake out, and the timing of it sometimes can mean everything. But yeah, it seemed like this was always going to be sort of a tough one matchup wise. And if you're Merab, you got your bite at the apple. You weren't able to make the most of it. You still can hang around and be a guy. He's well-liked. He's a fun guy to watch. No one's going to question that man's toughness ever after watching that fight. So, you know, you could be a guy who main events some fight nights. I'll just say, like, learn where the good places to eat are around the UFC apex. That would be my advice for Merab, because that's probably, he's got some of that probably in his future.
Chito, you mean?
Chito, yeah. That's what I mean, yes.
Marab's the guy in the pink suit who showed up backstage and tried to ask Sean O'Malley why he didn't mention his name in the post-fight interview, and Sean O'Malley said, I didn't know who that was. So, I can't remember if Dwalishvili was wearing a shirt underneath his pink blazer, or if he was rolling classic UFC fighter style with just the suit jacket but no shirt underneath.
Well, you remember when he snatched up the Michael Jackson jacket?
How could I forget? It's one of the greatest moments in UFC history.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think if I'm Merab, I start to make a habit of it, of just anybody who puts their jacket down, they turn around, I'm wearing it with no shirt on underneath. Yeah. That's my thing, you know?
Sort of a Paul Brothers gotcha hat kind of a thing, Merab Dwalishvili. Remember, you're listening to the Co-Main Event Proper Podcast, Podcast Proper, nailed it. This show drops every Monday afternoon for free in your timelines and your podcast libraries, but if you want to hear even more of the Co-Main Event, you can find Ben Folks and myself all week over on Patreon. Hit us up at patreon.com/co-main-event. Get loads of extra audio and video content, as well as access to our official Discord message board where they're talking fights and a lot of other stuff literally all the time. You know, the Sumo Basho, the March Sumo Basho kicked off yesterday. So there's a lot of interest over on the Discord about the sumo in general, and of course the March tournament. So there's a lot of talk about that over in our sumo channel. But hey, they're talking PFL, they're talking UFC, they're talking boxing, all this other stuff. Get over there and hang out with the people over there. It's a good crew of people. Just go to the website patreon.com/co-main-event and sign up to join the team. If you want to support the show in other ways, you could go to our merch site over at co-main-event.com and click the link at the top of the page that says shop. We got t-shirts, we got hats, we got hoodies, we got lots more. You can pick up the Daddest Man on the Planet coffee mug while we can keep him in stock. That's the hottest seller over there. You can also get the original Dundasso t-shirt. You can get the Bobby Knux t-shirt. You can get the Volcamania t-shirt. We got it all. Just go to our website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top of the page that says shop. We're partnering with our friends at Superconductor on the Shop. They're a brand and design studio from Portland, Oregon. We can't recommend them highly enough for all your design needs. Hit them up at studiosuperconductor.com or on Instagram at studiosuperconductor. Next question this week comes to us from Mr. Ofasho, who writes, is the result of Ngannou versus Joshua akin to, insert your big animal, dying and thus feeding an ecosystem? Ngannou went from $600,000 to $20 million purse and at least $10 million for the last fight. Can also fight Deontay Wilder for one last boxing bag. Tyson Fury gets to say he was right all along and that he carried Francis to boxing relevancy. Dana White will admit that this is a fight that he actually did watch and gets to talk about Francis and will incorporate into his promoter book of Psalms. Joshua gets Fury next in the biggest fight in UK history in Saudi Arabia. What are your thoughts? So I guess essentially what Mr. Ofasho is saying here is that basically Francis Ngannou is the giant rhino that died, and now all the animals can come up there and get a little bite of the action.
I mean, that's not a terrible analogy. It also worked out pretty good for Francis. Obviously, he didn't want to go out there and get absolutely slept like that. But you can't say that his foray into boxing was not a success for him in the ways that really count. He got to, you know, he bet on himself. He walked away out of his UFC contract still as the champion. He went over there, looked really good in one boxing match, not so great in the next one, but made more money than he would have made in a lifetime of fighting for the UFC. An absolute lifetime. And yeah, there's still more on the table that he can go do. He can go back to the PFL now. I'm sure that he could have at least one more boxing match if he wants it. He got options. So don't cry for Francis Ngannou. That said, it was a tough one. Yeah. A little bit of a tough one to watch as someone who likes Francis.
We had just recorded a Friday Power Hour over behind the Patreon paywall where we both agreed that the thing we didn't want to see was Francis Ngannou getting terribly knocked out. We said any other outcome would be just fine and you could probably chalk it down as a win for Big Fran. Then I go out with my family on Friday evening, early on Friday evening, and I get a text from you and all it says is, "Well, shit." And at that exact moment, I knew something terrible had happened to Francis Ngannou, and then I got to watch the fight after the fact and see it, and it was hard to watch the man get starched in that way. I mean, the thing is, we don't really know any of these people personally. For all I know, Francis Ngannou is out there behind the scenes doing crimes every day, but given what we know about him, he still seems like one of the best human beings that we have seen come out of this sport since the beginning of MMA. In the history of MMA, he seems like one of the good human beings to come out of the sport. And frankly, you're right. He has already sort of won the game of life before he even stepped in a boxing ring at all, especially when you consider where he started. But basically, from any metric of as an MMA fighter, going anywhere else and having two fights and earning a rumored $30 million is pretty good, even if you end up getting knocked out in the second one. And let's face it, this was the thing that we thought was supposed to happen to Francis Ngannou in boxing all along. It was just that his first fight against Tyson Fury perhaps unreasonably raised our expectations, right? You're like, oh, you have this fight against the so-called best heavyweight in the world, then you go fight Anthony Joshua, we expect maybe you're going to do okay, and then you don't. You look like the MMA fighter who jumped ship to boxing and tried to fight two of the best fighters in the world right out the gate. And so this was supposed to happen. But I'll tell you one thing. A lot of people are saying, well, this just proves that Tyson Fury took Francis Ngannou lightly in their first fight. And that's true. I think it does prove that. It kind of seems like maybe Tyson Fury didn't train one single day to go fight Francis Ngannou. But I will also tell you this, I don't care. Francis Ngannou going out there in his first ever professional boxing match and dueling the best heavyweight arguably of his generation to a tight decision loss is still a great performance. It's still an amazing performance, even if Tyson Fury came straight from the bar stool to the boxing ring. It's still an unbelievable story. So did Tyson Fury take Francis Ngannou lightly? Yes, obviously. Was it still an amazing performance by the UFC heavyweight champion to damn near beat the boxing champion in his first ever pro boxing champion? Also, yes.
Yeah. I mean, for about the first 90 seconds of this fight with Anthony Joshua, I was like, okay, Big Fran looks pretty decent here. And then, you know, he switched to southpaw, and the commentators were just kind of like, well, that's interesting, him switching to southpaw. You know, I think in MMA, we're way more used to stance switching just for a lot of reasons, you know, where you're trying to set up your takedowns, maybe your leg is getting kicked to shit, all kind of reasons that you might need to fight out of both stances. He switches to southpaw, and seconds later, eats a straight right that puts him down, and maybe is never back in the fight totally after that. Certainly, when he comes out for the second round and gets dropped right away, and when he got back up from that one, he was never really aware. And so Anthony Joshua could just walk forward and wallop him, and he had really no reaction because he seemed like he was just kind of on autopilot by that point.
Yeah.
And you're right that is kind of what was supposed to happen. It's also what we feared would happen. And yet, I can't get too mad at Francis Ngannou for you go out there, you do your best to try to jump in the deep end and catch up with the world's best boxers at the age of 37 at once. You know, Dana White, of course, as this question mentions, is going to do his Dana White stuff where he's like, well, see, this just shows Tyson Fury should have done this so that if he would actually trained for it, and basically Francis sucks and has sucked all along. And it's like, bro, he left as UFC champion, and when he did that, you said it was because he was risk averse, that he did not want to take those risks, which, again, we pointed out at the time, you're talking about a dude who tried to cross the ocean in an inflatable raft just to go live his dream of being a professional fighter on the streets of Paris like 6 different times. They do not make risk-averse people like that. The risk-averse version of Francis Ngannou is still in the sand mines. Like, that's a guy who was not afraid to go take some chances and try to do some shit. And here, he took some chances, he got knocked out, he can still have a fighting career if he wants one, he could just hang it up and be rich.
Yeah.
Like, that is the goal. How many MMA fighters we heard talk about, like, doing exactly what Francis Ngannou did? And nobody has done it as successfully as he has to this point. And frankly, like, the only thing I think that we should be saying about Francis Ngannou is good for you.
Yeah.
Please come back home now.
Yeah, well, that's
come
the thing.
Come back to PFL and fight that big scary dude.
He has a potentially pretty dangerous fight against Hannon Ferreira waiting for him in the PFL. We just saw Ferreira knock out Ryan Bader in a matter of moments. Not that Bader and Ngannou are comparable, but we think now Big Fran might come back. He might come back to the PFL and have this fight against Ferreira, which, I gotta be honest, is also not a gimme. It's not one that I don't know that we can expect him to just walk through at this point, especially at his age coming back into MMA. So we'll see what happens. He seems like a guy who's going to honor his commitment to the PFL. But I don't know that I would. I'll just say, I don't know that I would. I might be like, so long, thanks for all the cheese at this point. But Francis seems like the kind of guy who's going to do a solid for the PFL. And frankly, for Hennen Ferreira, who's going to get that $2 million.
Gonna get that $2 million whether he does a bad job or not. I would just say don't feel the need to turn right around and do that super soon.
Yeah,
like that was a bad knockout, dude. That was a bad one. He's 37 years old. Your brain not really gonna bounce back from that right away. Take some time.
He's also the kind of dude that's going to get on social media and make the saddest post ever about letting people down, where I was like, man, if there is any person on the face of this earth that feels like Francis Ngannou has let them down, fuck you.
Yeah.
You're an asshole. Fuck you.
You're saying if you're sitting around there early of a Friday evening, shaking your head at the stream that you maybe bought, maybe sailed the high seas for, and you're just going, damn it, Francis really let me down today.
Not even Drake. I don't even want to hear it from Drake. If you feel like Francis Ngannou let you down, fuck you.
I mean, maybe the way I think about it is that Drake let Francis Ngannou down by betting on him.
It's possible. It's a possibility. All right, next question this week comes to us from Darkwing Duck, who writes, it's Saturday night and I should be going to bed, but instead I've poured myself a drink of the good stuff and I'm sitting here thinking about Dustin Poirier. Is that weird? Anyway, what was cooler, that as soon as he started taking his corner's advice and stopped trying to catch a guillotine on Benoit Saint Denis, he won the fight? Or that after the fight, he declared that he'll never stop going for guillotines?
Did you see the meme Dustin Poirier posted where it was, you know, the guy walking with the girl while looking at another girl walking past, that classic meme?
Yeah.
Except it was Dustin Poirier ignoring the game plan to stare at jumping for the guillotine. I could only imagine what it was like for Mike Brown to watch that fight.
And because he had literally just told him.
He just said it. And it was like, Dustin said afterwards, Mike Brown's been telling me that all week. Probably been telling you that the entire time you've known each other. And he goes out there, jumps for like 3 guillotines in the first round. None of them particularly close. Benoit Saint Denis seems to know exactly what to do there. Gets out of every single one. And each time, Dustin Poirier just ends up putting himself on his back instead of defending a takedown. And you go back to the corner And Mike Brown is telling you, no more guillotines. Stop doing it. And he's clearly right. It's a bad idea. It's putting you in bad positions. And then what does he do? 20 seconds into the second round, Dustin Poirier going to sit there, listen to Mike Brown, nod his head like, yeah, yeah, I got you, coach. And then get up off that stool 20 seconds later, jump for a guillotine.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you're Dustin Poirier, that's a good win because you tried as hard as you could to lose and you still won.
Also, shout out to my man, John Anik, who after Dustin Poirier jumped for that guillotine in the second round, pointed out, to my knowledge, Dustin Poirier has never won a fight via guillotine.
That's his move, but he's never won a fight that way. He was almost a 2-1 underdog coming into this thing, as you and I both well know. But he goes out there and he made Benoit Saint-Denis look a little bit, I don't want to say amateurish, but just made him look unrefined, perhaps, as a striker. And, you know, had hurt him a couple of times earlier in this fight with punches. That was one of the reasons why it seemed so ill-advised for him to keep jumping for guillotines, because it seemed like he was doing okay on the feet. And then, you know, in there in the second round, he finally drops him with one and finishes him about halfway through the round. So, I don't know. It's always good to see cool Dusty P notch a win. And what can you say walking away from a win like this, aside from the fact that Dustin Poirier is exactly who we thought he was, and that is a tough-ass motherfucker who will also, perhaps, against his own better judgment, do things just because perhaps he thinks he might be able to successfully do them.
Yeah, I mean, we both took him in our $20 We Never Want to See Again segment just because I think I got plus 180 odds on him by the time I took him on Friday for that segment, and just because you put Dustin Poirier, cool Dusty P himself, up against a somewhat unproven but talented and promising young fighter who has never fought anybody of that level before, you give me underdog odds on that of any kind, I'm going to take them.
Yeah.
And that kind of showed why. I also saw Dustin Poirier, I don't know if it was talking to Ariel today or what, but saying that after he won the fight, the thing he looked through the fence to say to Dana White was, you really want me out here fighting these young guys, huh? Like, he knew. Dustin Poirier is an old dog in this game.
Yeah.
He's 35 years old. They book him against this 27-year-old French special forces dude or whatever who's finishing all his opponents. He can tell which way the wind blows. He knows what they're thinking. They're thinking, let us get some shine on this kid's name while Dustin Poirier is in decline but still very well known and respected and popular. And then it didn't go like that. And these are the tough ones. Like, we've seen a lot of fighters similar to Dustin Poirier find themselves in these kinds of fights where it's sort of like the UFC is feeling them out to be like, are you a stepping stone yet? Let's find out. Let's go out there and see if somebody can use you that way. Yeah. And then if we can then turn around and promote them on the back of that. And it's kind of a separate tier of fighter you put yourself in when you're 35 years old in one of the lighter weight classes and you go out there and you're like, not yet. I'm not a stepping stone yet.
Yeah. And also to hear Dustin Poirier's reasoning for why he accepted the fight with Benoit Saint-Denis is a reminder that, you know, while in combat sports, we will sit here all the time and say you should always take whatever pays you the most money 100% of the time and do that. But it is just a reminder that Dustin Poirier is seemingly an honorable man.
Yeah.
Among essentially thieves, because he's out here talking about how Eddie Alvarez did it for him back in 2018, giving him the opportunity to become a main event championship level contender in the UFC. And now he sees Benoit Saint-Denis coming up, finishing all of his fights. And basically he wanted to pay it forward to give Benoit Saint-Denis the opportunity to do that for himself and also like shut his lights off during that fight. So, but still honorable yeah. Move from Dustin Poirier. We got this question from Tomato Can Stan, who writes, Islam and cool Dusty P look like they're trying to work themselves into a shoot on X. Does that fight happen? And if it does, how bad did Gaethje fuck up by letting Dana talk him into fighting Max?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a bummer, right? If you're Justin Gaethje being like, all right, let's do this BMF stuff. I'm on UFC 300. Everybody's all excited about it. And then when your back is turned, the lightweight division is moving on without you. And you're like, Wait, what? That's not how this was supposed to go.
Yeah. I mean, if he beats Max, we still don't know what will happen. So,
yeah,
you know, that's title picture in the UFC shifts. The sands shift on a more or less hourly basis. So anything could happen in the wake of that UFC 300 fight. And honestly, I don't think any of us are going to argue with either of them. Islam against Poirier or Islam against Justin Gaethje. Either way.
Yeah, well, it also just seems like at this point, there's no one obvious person that it has to be at lightweight, you know? Like, for one thing, I'll just give me Islam Makhachev versus a lightweight is kind of what I ask. And as far as which one it is, we got a few guys who are always kind of right there in the running. And we both know the Irish fella could screw it up at any given moment just because of the way the business works. So, yeah, you can't sit here and tell me, like, if they announced Islam Makhachev versus Dustin Poirier, people would be like, oh, no, I have to watch one of the most popular and exciting fighters to get a shot for the title. I wanted to watch another one of the most popular and exciting fighters. Like, no. No one's going to feel that way.
Next question this week comes to us from Cactus McCoy, who writes, Greetings, gentlemen. Once again, I write from the not-yet-so-green outskirts of a small town in northern Germany, wondering what the hell is going on. After losing to Dustin Poirier, the rising contender Benoit Saint-Denis is the latest fighter to claim having suffered through a serious infection which has prevented him from fighting at his full potential. From bloody butts to horns on the forehead, the choice is yours. What exactly are the athletics commissions doing at medical checks before fights beyond asking fighters if they are okay? Whose responsibility is it to ensure that fighters are okay before the fight, at least? Should we officially declare these events blood sacrifices to a hungry deity? Enlighten me. So yeah, in the wake of this Benoit Saint-Denis, it had been noticed leading up to the fight that he appeared to have something on his forehead that could have been a staph infection or something that he was recovering from. In the wake of the fight, Benoit Saint-Denis, I believe he wrote this on his Instagram, and shout out to Stephen Morocco over at MMA Fighting for seemingly run it through Google Translate, as he says. This is a quote from Benoit Saint-Denis. Unfortunately, this evening, I was not able to fully express myself. My body didn't respond after a week of antibiotics to fight an infection. Throughout, I was present, but my body was absent. It did not react as usual. I only had one round to give you. Now, if that ain't the most French thing I have ever heard as a way of describing a loss, I don't know what is. I was unable to fully express myself. Also, didn't you, though?
You're saying you don't think that he lost that one because of antibiotics?
I mean, at no point were we punched
in the face by Dustin Poirier.
Yes, at no point were we like, oh, Benoit Saint-Denis he's slowed down. His body will no longer react the way the brain is telling it. No, we were like, he's doing good until he wasn't. So I don't know.
He got hurt.
Unless those antibiotics undermined your chin. Like, I don't know that we can blame this loss on them. I don't know if we can blame your inability to express yourself fully on the antibiotics.
As far as the question about, like, what are the athletic commissions doing here? Like, because he's basically saying it was like, I got staff in training camp, had to get on a regimen of antibiotics, and I felt that the antibiotics left me depleted. Which, he's not the first fighter to make that exact argument. And The athletic commission is in a position there where who knows if he went in there and was like, hey guys, just so you know, in my pre-fight medical questionnaire, this thing on my forehead is indeed staph. But even if he's not saying that, I think people think that these athletic commission processes for pre-fight screenings are a lot more rigorous than they are. It's not like when you go to get a physical because an NFL team is trying to trade you and they're like looking to make sure all the parts are still on. It's not really like that. Like, they don't want to find anything wrong with these guys. They want the fights to go on as scheduled. That's where the incentives are for everybody. The State Athletic Commission wants these fights to happen and the money to roll in and all that stuff to be good. They don't want to make the UFC mad at them. They want the UFC to go out there, have a good show, mention the many tax revenue generating businesses in downtown Miami in just a seamless like sponsor integration on the broadcast, because you think Miami, Chad, obviously the first thing you think of is the tax revenue generating businesses of downtown Miami. That's everybody knows that.
Yeah. Thank well, someone please think of the businesses.
Yes. So like they don't want to notice that there's something wrong with you. They want to have that questionnaire to cover their asses if afterwards you were like, I had one lung and my spleen was lacerated, and they want to be like, well, it's not our fault. He lied to us on the questionnaire, because if he had wrote lacerated spleen, we'd have pulled him out of the fight. And so that part, I think people just think that there is a way more like intense system in place. Because I've talked to fighters before who told me about like, oh, okay, I got cut shortly before the fight. I was worried about it. Couldn't go get stitches because, you know, it's too close to the fight. So I glued it shut. I remember some guy telling me once, he glued it shut. He was really concerned that the athletic commission was going to notice and that he was going to be ruled out of the fight. So he went to like a beauty salon to get a makeup expert to apply the makeup to cover it up so that the athletic commission wouldn't see the cut, and put all this work into making sure they got somebody who was really great with makeup and could do this, and then went in there and the athletic commission people just said that he was like, they didn't even like glance up at my face. Like I could have rolled in there with just, you know, a smear of concealer on there or something and been just fine. And I had gone through all this trouble just to make sure, like, that's not what they're doing in there.
Right.
You know,
every single link in the chain is incentivized to make sure that the fights happen. And if you are an athletic commission that consistently prevents fights from happening, what do you think is going to happen? Probably the big time fight promoter who can take his show anywhere he wants to in the world, it's not going to come back that often. And if you are the doctor, I don't know if these doctors are out here doing this for financial reasons for the athletic commission. Sometimes it's not that at all. But if you are the doctor for the athletic commission that keeps ruling people out of their fights, guess what happens to you? Do you think the athletic commission is going to come back and be like, hey, man, you did such a good job making a bunch of fights fall apart the first time. We'd love to have you come back and work for us again. No.
Yeah.
Neither of those things. That's,
I remember Margaret Goodman telling me about how her husband, Flip Womansky, when he was the like head doctor of the Nevada State Athletic Commission, had written an article once called How to Do the Right Thing and Be the Most Hated Man in Boxing. And, you know, it's essentially that and telling people when it's time, telling fighters when it's time to retire, when they've taken too much damage. And as much as we might pretend otherwise, the sport in general, it just doesn't want to hear it, doesn't want it to actually work that way.
Next question this week comes to us from Aljamain Plumbum. Now, if I'm not mistaken, plumbum is Latin for lead. I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly, but plumbum sound, it sounds different. It sounds like you're trying to imply something different using that word, but I believe that it's Latin for lead. So we are making yet another pun about the last name of Aljamain Sterling.
I'm glad we're having fun with it and keeping it fresh.
Yeah. Aljamain Plumbum writes, flat nose Jack also has an iron effing chin and ice in his veins. Burns hit him with some shots. Then he calls out Shavkat. Imagine that fight. Please discourse. Jack Della Maddalena went out there and landed a pretty solid knee against Gilbert Burns in the third round of their fight. Finished him off on the mat for a KO. This was one that it kind of felt to me like Jack Della Maddalena needed to win, despite the fact that he is now on an insane 17-fight win streak. But he had, you know, the two split decision wins over Kevin Holland and Basil Hafez, previous to that. And so this was one that he needed to come out and show that he can go out there and compete with the elite in his division. And Gilbert Burns, he's that guy. Like he's a little bit of a gatekeeper perhaps at this point, but going out there and getting a good stoppage win against Gilbert Burns is still meaningful. And that's what Jack Della Maddalena was able to do. So he did exactly, I guess, what he needed to do to maintain his status or improve his status, in fact, in the welterweight division.
He did. And yet at the same time, if I am Shavkat, that boy, Good Rachmanov, and I just watched that fight where Gilbert Burns came very close to beating you with just wrestling and grappling alone, I go, yes, please give me that fight next. I'll take it. I'll take it all day long. Just because stylistically, You have some paths to victory in that fight. I gotta give credit to Jack Della Maddalena, because there was that moment in this one where, you know, Gilbert Burns gets a takedown that he desperately needs in the third round, and then gets on his back, and it's just, and Joe Rogan, I think, said something where he was like, there's like 2 minutes left, and he's just like, if Jack Della Maddalena can't find a way to get up here, they're going to end the fight like this, and he's going to lose. And he was down on the scorecards at that point. And he basically just decides, like, fuck this, one way or another, I'm getting up. And he does. And then he knows that Gilbert is going to be desperate to just get him right back down again. And so he just sort of like reads the timing on that and catches him perfectly with that knee right as Gilbert is dropping, changing levels, trying to get that takedown, and manages to pull it off there at the end. But, and it's like, Gilbert Burns is going to be a tough fight for anybody still at this point. You know, he might be getting along in years a little bit. Maybe the record doesn't look absolutely spectacular at times, but like, Gilbert Burns is still a tough, tough dude. And if you are not ready for that next level, he's going to find it out.
Yeah.
And he, there were some moments in there where you're just like, okay, JDM has still some holes in the game against a certain type of fighter. Shavkat could do that to him. You know, Shavkat can do other stuff too, but like, Shavkat can get you down and then get you in some tough spots where you're going to give up a submission. Like, he can just stay after you and grind after you that way. So I think that's, I respect the brass balls on Flat Nose Jackie to come out of this fight and be like, I want one of the toughest dudes who still is not super well known outside the hardcore circles. Give me that guy next. Because that is a tough-ass fight, man. Like, that's not, let me look around for somebody who has a name, somebody that I stand, like, stylistically plays right into my strengths. Like, no, that's, you're asking for a tough fight that you're probably not going to be the betting favorite for if they make it. Respect, but also, I was not surprised to see Shavkat jump right up afterwards and be like, yes, I respect you, but you will meet the fate of all my former opponents.
Very Shavkat. Are you talking about Brass Balls Jackie right now? Is that who you're talking about?
Listen, we can't keep doing this.
He does look like someone took a frying pan and just like tapped him on the front of his face with it and just,
yeah,
it's totally flat, straight up and down. It's flat.
You don't really think about it until you see him in profile. Because yeah, they were doing during the introductions, you know, they're straight on. You're like, yeah, okay, you could see his nose a little bit fucked up. And then as soon as he turns his head at all and you see him in profile, you're like, damn.
Yeah. If I had to cast an early 20th century hooligan in my prestige drama for Netflix, and he didn't have very many lines, he just had to stand there in a newsboy cap and look hooliganish, I would cast Jack Della Maddalena in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Next question this week comes to us from Matt Webb, who says, Michael Venom Page frustrated the hell out of Kevin Holland. Tough fight. MVP definitely styled on him. Holland just never had a chance to get anything going. Good fight, though. Also, give me Wonder Boy versus MVP immediately. We got numerous emails of people calling for Michael Venom Page versus Wonder Boy Thompson, the Wonder Man. This was impressive. This was exactly the kind of UFC debut that you wanted to see from Michael Venom Page, to come in there and basically toy with Kevin Holland, who is a UFC mainstay. You can say what you want to about Kevin Holland, but he's a regular, man. He's one of these guys that goes out there night in and night out and fights people in the UFC cage. And so for Michael Venom Page to come in and not just beat him, but do all of his Michael Page shit during the fight was exactly what you needed to see from a guy who, you know, despite the fact that he is no spring chicken himself, is a guy that the UFC clearly is going to want to do something with. And so it was good to see him go out there at 36 years old. He's about to be 37 and show that he's the guy that they think he can be.
Normally Kevin Holland gets into a fight, and if it turns out to be weird and just sort of a quirky, all over the place kind of fight, that is to his strengths.
Yeah.
Normally, it's other people want to slow him down into a different kind of a fight, not him trying to do it to the other guy. So it's like, it's a good bit of matchmaking for one thing. And I give credit to the UFC for doing it that way, rather than The old UFC in years past might have, when they got an opportunity to sign somebody like MVP from a different organization, put him up against some grinder of a wrestler who's just going to make him look bad and beat him just so you can be like, see, we had the best fighters. But they didn't. Here they went, what would be the most fun possible matchup for MVP? Kevin Holland. It makes sense. And it was. It was a fun fight and one where MVP just made Kevin Holland look kind of lost at moments in that fight where he's just like, he's either way too far away from you or he's right on top of you, elbowing you in the face and then foot sweeping you. And you just look dumb and frustrated. And that was impressive to see. I also, though, I did see MVP immediately afterwards. He was talking to Aaron Bronstetter, I believe, about the prospect of a fight with Stephen Thompson, where he's like, everybody always brings that up because we both have like that karate style. But he was like, I think that fight could be boring because I think we'd both be standing there trying to do our stuff and reading each other a whole lot, but not a whole lot would be happening. And I think that people might actually not like it if they saw it. Plus, he was like, I like Stephen Thompson and I don't want to hit him. And I could see what he's saying there. I think that there are some interesting matchups, but we can think outside the box a little bit. We don't just have to be like, make the one karate guy fight the other karate guy, you know?
I don't know. It seems like a tried and true method. To me, sounds like a great idea. Michael Page, he's another one of these people that seems like he's a pretty good dude. Like, good honorable guy out there making his way in the world of combat sports. The other thing that I want to say just before we close out about MVP is, let's keep our antenna up for the UFC talking about how they made this guy a star.
Oh, no.
Just like they did for Ronda Rousey, because I was watching this fight and I was like, it made me think back to the claim of the antitrust lawsuit that the UFC says it has some manner of special promotional sauce. And I was like, there's no special sauce. The UFC is just putting these people in fights that other people watch. And honestly, that's more on us as the MMA fans than anything else, because Michael Page is just out there doing the same shit to Kevin Holland he was doing in Bellator for years. And now we're all going to suddenly be like, oh, this guy's great. He should fight Wonderboy or whatever. It's just like, I don't know, man. This, we just watched him. It's the only thing the UFC did for him. They gave him exposure.
Do you think that Mike Perry was sitting at home watching this fight and being like, I beat this dude in bare knuckle boxing. No big deal.
Yes. I think Mike Perry's doing that every day, all day.
By at home, I mean at Buffalo Wild Wings shortly before being 86'd.
Next question this week comes to us from the Jesse White Deer. He writes, howdy. Hope you two beautiful guys are doing well. You deserve it. Thanks, Jesse. That's nice. Wow. Anyway, is our guy Curtis Razor Blades the human equivalent of the call an ambulance, but not for me meme? Just when you think he's on his way to a losing streak, he fucks around and beats up a promising heavyweight. Old Curtis Blades hasn't lost two in a row his entire career. I mean, shit, dude, that's got to be an achievement on its own. Best wishes, warm regards from your pal in Oklahoma, the Jesse White Deer. We got a lot of emails this week about Curtis Blades, who went out there and had a come-from-behind victory against Jailton Almeida, and a lot of people comparing Curtis Blades to funny shit, like the call an ambulance but not for me meme, and also the Undertaker coming out of the casket to grab somebody by the throat. I don't know. It seems accurate to me. It seems like Curtis Blades is another one of these dudes that you probably don't want fighting your up-and-coming prospect. Because he's could fuck around and beat them.
We talked about it beforehand. We were like, okay, Jailton Almeida seems to be a fighter that the UFC is very excited about. You know, hasn't lost in the UFC. Frankly, you know, hasn't lost since the very early days of his career. And then if he comes in here, you know, had that lackluster win over Derek Lewis. But if he can come in here and beat Curtis Blades and look good doing it, it puts him in the title conversation. Whereas if Curtis Blades wins, people go, attaboy Curtis. And he does not necessarily move any closer to the title situation unless several other people are in a plane crash. And this is kind of what happened, I think, because it's like he goes out there. The first round is just him getting controlled and kind of looking up like, shit, we're not going to do this the whole time, are we? And then, you know, in the second round proves, again, as we've seen other times in MMA, it is still a bad idea, especially in a heavyweight fight, to shoot for a takedown. And when you don't get it, just kind of stay there taking shots on the side of your head, hoping that the other guy gets tired of hitting you so you can go back to completing your takedown attempt. Like, we've seen other people try that. It doesn't go well for them. Curtis Blades makes the most of that opportunity here. It is impressive, honestly, that a guy, a heavyweight who's been around for this long. I mean, Curtis Blaydes made his UFC debut in 2016.
Yeah.
And has not lost two in a row in his career. The list of Curtis Blaydes' losses looks like Francis Ngannou twice, Derek Lewis, Sergey Pavlovich. Like, that ain't too bad.
Nope.
For a guy who's been around as long as he has.
Yeah, one of the reasons a number of people need to die in a plane crash before the UFC gives him a title shot is that he could win.
Yes.
He could absolutely win and become your UFC heavyweight champion. And I don't know if that is what the UFC is angling toward at this point. My favorite part of this fight, great performance by Curtis Blaydes. My favorite part of this fight was Daniel Cormier calling bullshit on Jailton Almeida's single round takedown record. Because they were really trying to pump that up on the broadcast. And you know Daniel Cormier, he's not going to let that slide. He's sitting over there being like, I don't know, man. He's not unlocking his grip. These are just mat returns, as far as I'm concerned. These aren't individual takedowns, just mat returns. And I was like, hell yeah, Daniel Cormier. Give it to him. It's my favorite part.
I mean, them talking about takedown records to Daniel Cormier is like somebody asking you about Big Sky Conference football. Like, yeah. You want to push that button, take that ride, that's on you. You got to know what you're going to get into there.
Yeah, and also him talking about how heavyweights panic when somebody picks him up because that doesn't normally happen. Loving it. Love his work. Next question this week comes to us from Trevor Finch, who writes, so 27-year-old Jake Paul has a fight with 57-year-old Mike Tyson. Are you fucking kidding me? First, let me say props to Iron Mike for being able to step in the ring at Check's Notes again. 57.
He'll be 58, actually, by the time that fight happens. Turns 58 in June.
I am early 40s, and the thought of getting through 1 3-minute round of a heavyweight fight is crazy. I was fine with the Roy Jones Jr. exhibition bout because it was two guys of a certain age, but I have major concerns with this one. I really don't want to see Mike hurt. If he catches a bad one at his age, recovery could be long. That said, the fan in me wants to see Iron Mike lay a man out one more time. How do I square these feelings? How?
Did you see that, according to Ariel Helwani, he was saying that, you know, hearing different things still about how they're going to do this. For one thing, are they going to do it as a professional fight? He said, according to Ariel, he was saying that early indications are that they would like to do it as a professional fight if they can get it past the commission, basically. Because trying to get a soon-to-be 58-year-old Mike Tyson licensed as a professional could be a little bit of a hurdle. And they also, according to Ariel, were looking at how you want to configure this to do this in Cowboys Stadium, basically, and that they were looking at setting it up as like a 60 to 80,000 person venue for the event, which, bro, be serious. Be serious. Be real with yourself about that one. Because this is not Taylor Swift. You're not getting 80,000 people. Isn't the Saitama Super Arena for the Pride Openweight Grand Prix or some shit? You are not getting 80,000 people to buy tickets and show up to see Mike Tyson versus Jake Paul in the year of our Lord 2024. You know that's not going to happen. You can give these tickets away and you're not going to get 80,000 people to show up on the night.
You know what is interesting, though, is that I have talked to a couple of fight fans over the last whatever week or so since they announced this fight. And I would say that the people who don't watch fights think that Mike Tyson is going to win.
He's Mike Tyson.
Yeah. The people I've talked to have been like, whoa, too bad for Jake Paul. Can't wait for Mike Tyson to knock that guy out. And I've just been like, you know, this is what Jake Paul does, right? Like, yeah. This is squarely in his wheelhouse. This is his shit. Is to fight the aging legend that you love just so he can beat them. So you got to give
him... Well, and frankly, this is the shit he should be doing.
Yeah.
Like this, I can't get mad at Jake Paul for this. This is the shit that has proven to work.
Yeah.
And especially if they're going to do it on Netflix and like to a broader audience that is just like, okay, what is happening on the streaming service that I might already have? Like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna see what the hell that weirdo curiosity is. Like, I get it. It's way better than Jake Paul boxing boxers you never heard of, trying to pad his record in the old-time boxing tradition, and nobody gives a shit. You know, like, this is what he should be doing, fighting these people where when you hear about it, you go, either you don't know enough about fighting and you think, well, this influencer kid is going to get murdered because you don't know how time and the ravages of age work, or you go, this son of a bitch, he would never in his life think about picking on prime Mike Tyson, is going to wait until Mike is closing in on Social Security to go and try to get a fight with him just so he can say he beat Mike Tyson. And there is no way that a just and loving God would allow Jake Paul to walk the earth with a win over Mike Tyson. It simply can't be allowed. Damn it, I will hate watch it. Yeah. Like, that's what he's going for. And Mike Tyson is maybe like the perfect person to choose at this point for it.
Yeah, as soon as I saw the fight poster float across my timeline, my first response was, have I taken ayahuasca or some other hallucinogenic drug? But then once
Ben finally followed through on his threat to put acid in your toothpaste.
But then I was like, oh, you know, this is Jake Paul's final form. This is him. He has perfected it. This is his masterpiece creation, is this fight. So we'll see what happens, I guess. Now, this question from Ryan Robinson is interesting, from over on the Patreon page. Senior technologist for the Co-Main Event podcast, Ryan Robinson, helps us out with our live streaming endeavors over there. He writes, in order to navigate in three dimensions, you need to have three separate reference points. I'd like to identify three recent events, and I am very curious what course you see the MMA world charting from them. Number one. One celebrated International Women's Day with an all-women's card of Muay Thai, submission grappling, and MMA. It was broadcast at no additional charge on Amazon Prime, accessible and in high res around the world. Number two, Francis Ngannou and Anthony Joshua celebrated the successful sports washing of the oppressive Saudi regime with a spectacle largely devoid of competition. It was broadcast almost as an afterthought, and the target audience seemingly was Saudi royalty. Women in Saudi Arabia cannot leave the country without the permission of a man. Number three, Jake Paul is going to fight the aging convicted rapist Mike Tyson. This card is going to be broadcast on Netflix at no additional charge to a huge audience. Where are we? Where are we going? And what the fuck is going on? Now, even if you don't want to grapple with the gender implications that Ryan brings up here, which I think are legitimate and worthy of discussion, this also casts what a weird time it is right now in general for combat sports, because you do indeed have all of these different money sources and all of these different streaming situations and all of these different monetization efforts happening. And it's just very weird that, you know, you got one giving their shit away essentially for free if you have Amazon Prime. You got ESPN hiding the UFC from us, but also taking away all of the financial risk from the UFC just so they essentially have pure profits. And then you've got the Saudi Arabia looking to get into this fight business in a situation where they don't care how much money they lose or who even watches the fights. It's very strange right now.
Well, it is strange. I would point out that, you know, if we're going to talk about what course you see the MMA world charting from them, you know, we're talking about different sports, different things going on here that are not technically all MMA based. You know, they're playing to an MMA adjacent crowd. They're playing to a portion of the Venn diagram of MMA fans there. So fair. But also, like, I think what we are seeing all around right now is that with the multitude of streaming services, where we've reached sort of this critical mass of streaming services that are all trying to find something that they can offer you, and live sports is still maintaining an appeal for them that kind of no other form of broadcasting can do, you know? And relatively quickly and easily, because it's like you could tell yourself, like, oh, we're going to be the people that get really into prestige drama and we're going to spend millions of dollars trying to make a True Detective type show. And it's like, if we've learned anything from Showtime, it's that shit is harder than it looks.
Yeah.
And that just because you spend the money doesn't mean that people will end up regarding it as the big time prestige drama. Live sports, on the other hand, if you're like, we went and got a goddamn spectacle, we either went and we spent a ton of money to get something that is a very, very proven commodity like the NFL or something like that, or we went and got some live sports thing that is just weird enough and interesting enough that you were like, well, I should stick around, keep the subscription active or reactivate it in order to see this one just because what the fuck. And I don't know, as far as like what that means for the MMA world, I think it means that the UFC is in for a huge price increase when their current deal with ESPN is up, whether that comes from ESPN itself or whether it comes from somebody else. I think it just means that their hopes of seeing a huge, huge bump are justified. Because if you're looking around, you're going like, okay, what could we get? What can we get that makes it an instant thing where like we get some new subscriptions and this and people who are just going to keep those subscriptions on for as long as we have this thing? The UFC is one of those, you know?
And then the other side of Ryan Robinson's question, the gender part of it is that I think, well, you know, combat sports continues to be, unfortunately, a male-dominated niche, and you are all always going to have different visions of how women and the female athletes in the sport are treated. And in some ways, I think you could make the argument that MMA does better than a lot of sports in how it presents its female combatants. And I think in some ways you could present the argument that, to quote the Big Lebowski, Jackie Treehorn treats objects like women, man.
Right. But I mean, the way you have to phrase it, honestly, is it's like, hey, the UFC treats its female fighters just as bad as it treats the men. You know, like it is. I think you do have to be honest and say MMA is one of the few sports where the women's version of the sport just exists right alongside with the men's, not as a separate thing, not as a thing where you have a whole bunch of people who are a fan of the men's version and not the women's version. Like, they exist on the same cards. You get the fans to be super invested in both of them. It's not treated as like, there's this thing and then there's the chick version. Like, that's not how MMA and the UFC presents it. I mean, again, the UFC will tell you that it's like a pioneer of this stuff when really it was a very late adopter of women's MMA. But still, I think it does better than most other sports. And it's like when other sports where you're looking at it and you're like, the women are paid so much less than the men. And it's like here, I mean, the pay is probably way more comparable and it's shitty on both sides.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, yeah, do they treat them as like objects that we are going to exploit for our professional sports organization? Yeah, but they do that to the men too. You know, maybe slightly different in some ways. As far as what you're saying though about like, the way the MMA demographic is, I think that we have seen and been reminded over and over that just in general, the MMA demographic, and especially the one that we hear and see showing up to live events, is generally more right-wing than the sports fans of many other sports.
We got a bunch of questions about Donald Trump coming to the event, and I don't even know how much we care to talk about it at this point. I don't necessarily know that anybody likes it. When we bring that,
some people seem to love it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I'll just say this. One of the things that I think is interesting, without straying too far into my opinion, is that the UFC and Donald Trump are clearly using each other.
Yeah.
Right? Their relationship is phony to the extent that we see it on camera, right? I think that Dana White and Donald Trump legitimately enjoy a friendly relationship, which
yeah,
is...
Well, they're the same kind of dude, the kind of dude who the only requirement for me liking you is that you are also rich and powerful and you say nice things about me.
But they're clearly like using each other, right? Like Donald Trump yeah. is using the UFC essentially to promote himself and pander to a demographic of young men who could arguably be disillusioned and in some cases probably apolitical and in some cases impressionable, right?
Yeah.
That's what he's there for. He's not there because he likes the fights. As our guy, former UFC PR guy, Ant Evans, tweeted over the weekend, Donald Trump hadn't been to a UFC event since 2001, and now he suddenly starts showing up again. It's not because he's a fight fan. It's because he wants something out of it. And at the same time, the UFC is clearly taking steps to, in some ways, turn itself into a right-wing brand, right?
Yes.
That's the sponsors they're getting. That's the people they're marketing toward. And so they are using Donald Trump to come to the events to get Donald Trump supporter people to pay attention to the UFC. And I think that you saw that with Sean Strickland recently, where a bunch of fucking noobs came into the sport and had no idea what they were seeing or who they were supposed to cheer for or what was happening aside from Sean Strickland. And so it's just, they have this like symbiotic relationship that is phony and some would argue gross.
Well, they seem to be leaning harder and harder into it, too. Like, before, it's like, okay, we're going to get this shot of Donald Trump walking out. Now, he gets more of a walkout than a lot of the fighters get. We're playing his music. He's walking out with Dana White. The camera's going to linger on him, even with no commentary, for just an extended period of time. We're going to keep cutting back to him. You know, like, he is getting a whole lot of attention out of it. You could also argue one of the things that the UFC hopes to get out of it is that if Donald Trump becomes president again, if you need help getting a visa for, you know, a Dagestani or Chechen fighter or somebody you're trying to get into the country to fight at one of your events, you can call up your good buddy Donald Trump. If you run into some issues with the National Labor Review Board or something trying to talk about how you're classifying your athletes, you could call up Donald Trump. He could be a good friend to have, I'm sure, is one part of Dana White's calculation for it. But yeah, also, we are very much just trying to, we've abandoned that whole keeping out of politics, just sports. The thing Dana White was saying during the pandemic, right? We don't even want to talk about the pandemic because we want this to be an escape. We want this to be a way away from the real world where we are just offering you sports and entertainment, except for when it aligns with Dana White's own personal political beliefs. Like, basically, you know, he's decided that we're going all in on this stuff. As you said, it helps us sell advertising to right-wing sponsors. We live in an age where it's like, I keep seeing ads, Chad, for the right-wing phone company. The mobile phone company. It's like where all their messaging is right-wing coded, as if like I'm sitting around being like, shh, tired of this woke phone carrier. Like, there's got to be a better way. You know, that's just like a lot of people have figured out this is a way to make money, yeah, is to cater to a right-wing audience that is just like super scared of changes in the society, and you can sell them on being like, we're your grandpa's phone company, basically. And so the UFC sees an opportunity to do that, and it's doing it. It's the thing that I want to make very clear, and I'm sure it's clear to most people who are in the CME listening audience at this point, just in case, since this is the proper and not one of the Patreon properties, somebody else might be hearing the sound of my voice. Let me make clear to you, if you are marking out for any politician, especially a old rich guy who was president and wouldn't let you into his golf club unless you were there to fix the toilet, you are a dork, bro. That is dork shit. They do not give a damn about you. They never will give a damn about you. If you're out here cheering, I mean, like, yeah, former US President Donald Trump, like, that is the dorkiest thing you can do. That is so lame, and you should be ashamed of yourself for. Similar for the fighters. All the fighters want to go over there and pal around with Donald Trump. At this point, we know we don't expect fighters to have good social or political viewpoints anymore. We know that. And yet, you do want to tell those guys, like, you know this dude hates you, right? Like, if you were not somebody who was, like, famous in pro sports or had, like, some kind of fan base you could lend to him, some way you could help him, like, the only way he would want to know you is if it helps him. He thinks you guys are all like disgusting poor slime.
And just a reminder, we'll stop talking about him when the motherfuckers stop bringing him to the shows.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Just bringing him to the shows, giving him a walkout, Chad. Yeah,
I know. It's a fucking campaign.
There's guys who fight at the UFC Apex who are like, I can't get a little bit of camera time going out there, stripped to the waist, fighting for you guys. Okay.
It's a campaign ad. All right, that's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event podcast. Like we said, we're over on the Patreon page all week. We wish you would come hang out with us there if you are cool. As for right now, though, we are done. We are through. We are out. I started thinking about a terrifying question this past week. Do you think Dana White could be president? What would happen if Dana White ran for president?
I mean, there is a videotape of him slapping his wife at a club in Mexico on New Year's Eve. You'd like to think you still live in a country where that would disqualify you. And yet, I'm not sure. I'll tell you what would happen if there'd be a whole lot of Spearmint Rhino employees coming forward to collect their big bag of casino chips. You know what I'm saying?
That hasn't happened for Trump yet.
That did happen.
Yeah, I know, but it hasn't mattered.